Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. And this is Carl from the ISF podcast. And today we're actually with Incredibly Strange Television, IST. And we're going to be talking about a Filipino anime series, which is on Netflix. I was very, very happy to run across a review of it by our guest, who's a good friend and is the premier Filipino TV and film reviewer here in the States. And that would be Noel Vera. Noel, nice to have you back on the show, man.
Yeah, glad to be back.
Well, very, very cool. So what I would suggest everyone is to get a chance and really listen, read Noel's review. You can find him on Facebook, and that's Noel, N-O-E-L, Vera, B-E-R-A. But Noel, why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, your reactions to it, and just the sense that there's actually an anime series that we here in the West can actually watch that reflects your culture, which I think is absolutely phenomenal.
Well, it's unheard of. For one thing, we don't do a lot of animation. Anime is hard to do in the Philippines. Anime is hard to do, period. I mean, in any country, it's labor-intensive. It costs a lot of money, and we never have enough labor, and we never have enough money in the Philippines. So animation's just simply hard to do. It's not a lot of features. So this is a first. Number one, it's Filipino anime. Number two, it's Filipino anime on horror. And number three, it's Filipino anime on Netflix. So it all counts. Yeah, it's the first.
Yeah.
And it's called Trece, which is 13 in Spanish. The Philippines was a former Spanish colony for about 300 plus years. And it's all about a girl, Alexandra Trece, and when the police have a case that's too strange for them, something unusual, something of supernatural origin or something, they call her in. She's like a special consultant. And then she takes on these cases that are too weird for the police to handle. That's what I've got so far.
Okay, so one of the things that I found very interesting was the sense of Filipino folklore. And of course, as you know, I'm very interested in mythology and theology and such. Now, I knew a little bit about the folklore. You know, I knew what an Aswang was, or at least what the American version of it is, you know, Americanized version. But give us a little bit of background on the mythology and what they use within the series.
Yeah. Some of the creatures you're going to encounter in the series, and by all means, this is not all the creatures. There's some that might show up, hopefully, in future seasons. But Aswang is the equivalent of the vampire in European mythology. There's some differences, some marked differences. The Aswang doesn't have fangs traditionally. What they have is a small tube in place of a tongue. And what happens is that a swan will climb on the roof of a house of a pregnant woman, and their tongue will go sneak down into the window, sneak up a woman's uterus, and suck out the fetus inside.
Yikes!
How do you like that?
And that's not exactly how it's visualized within the series, though.
The series doesn't show all that yet. I'm hoping to see it in some future episode, but traditionally that's how it goes. in the series, it's a little stranger than that. He, Trece, Alexander Trece comes off as a sort of, you know, like a special hard-boiled detective called in special consultant supernatural like that. But her real role is more of, what do you call it, a mediator. Her father, Anton Trece, used to be the, what they call, enforcer, something like that, in between the human world and the supernatural world. What the father had done was create some kind of treaty between the creatures and the humans. And the father has since passed away and taken over enforcing that treaty. So she's more like an ambassador, emissary, representative of the humans, and mediator among various species, natural and supernatural.
Right. I think the term they use is Lacan, if I'm not
mistaken. Yeah, that's right. I remember that. Yeah, it is. Lacan is the exact word that they're using.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I did, now, when I watched it specifically in the English, okay, to get through the whole series. But then I went back and watched an episode or two in the Filipino language, which is Tagalog. So my question is for you, when you watched it, did you do the English dub, or did you watch it in Tagalog?
Yeah. What do you call this? I did watch part of an episode in English, and it's not bad. The accents are more Hispanic, Latin American than actual Tagalog, although there's some genuinely Tagalog or Filipino accents. The Filipino, there's a little bit of controversy because the fans of the graphic novel or the manga or what have you wanted one actress. They chose a more famous actress. I understand the controversy about it. I'm okay with the performance of the actress they chose, Lisa Soberano. If you look at on Google, she's quite striking, lovely-looking actress.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. She does have a slightly American accent. But to my ears, they're perfect. It's perfectly acceptable, or it's acceptable enough that it's not distracting. I can understand people who struggle, mostly Filipinos, but, you know, I think it's okay. It's passable. It's not probably the best, but I think it's okay.
Yeah, They have a special on Netflix. Now, of course, let's make sure that everyone knows that Trece is available on Netflix. But they also have a special that I watched, which introduced all of the actors. They had the American actress, Shay. They had the Filipino actress. They had the two original creators, the illustrator and the writer of the manga. You know, and then they had the producer who is Filipino but based in L.A. And various things. But the one thing I do want to make sure that everyone knows is that all the people involved in this are all Filipino, or at least have Filipino heritage. They might be Filipino American, but nonetheless.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing that I find really interesting about this. I mean, you know, you see a lot of Japanese and manga and anime and so on and so forth, and you see American takes on it. But to me, and I did mention this earlier, it's the folklore. It's the sense of place, too. Manila, you know, as shown in the manga, as shown in the anime, is from what I understand, it's very, very real life. I mean, they tried to make it as real as possible. Would you say that's true?
I haven't been in Manila since 2003. I'm in a self-imposed exile, so to speak. But there are a lot of places I recognize there, yes. It's amusing to realize the lightning creature, the creature made out of thunder and lightning. Yeah, his headquarters is recognizing the Meralco building, the Manila Electric Company building. That's a very distinct structure along Ortigas. And, who knew that the Manila Power Company was run by a supernatural lightning creature?
There you go. Well, it makes actual sense to me.
Right, right.
But you know, I'm not a huge anime fan to begin with. I prefer a more American, I guess, American style to it, which harkens back to true animation and more of the characters, you know, like Bakshi and so on and so forth. However, the one thing I do think about this particular anime is that the background work is absolutely stellar. I mean, you know, I mean, you get the sense of the faces not having as much character and movement, you know, as in general anime. But the background work, and that's why I mentioned, you know, Manila and how it stands out in that, and Presa, I think is absolutely stellar. I think it's really, really good.
Sure. American animation is unmatched in how smooth they make it. And really, it's a matter of, like, having the time and the money to spend the time and hire the people to make animation smooth. Now, with low-budget stuff, you're naturally going to have jerkier animation, maybe not as expressive, so on and so forth. But if the story is strong enough, the ideas are strong enough, and I think the ideas here and the story and the voice performances are strong enough, I think it carries through. Another thing is, you know, Netflix tends to lowball its animation or projects. There's another animator, Japanese one, Masaki Yuasa, who did one animation series last year called Japan Sinks, literally about the Japan sinking in the ground. And they kind of lowballed his animation budget. You can tell from the animation. But he's a great storyteller, and if you're able to, you know, get carried along by the story and ideas, why not?
Well, you know, that's the one thing that truly made me just watch this thing all the way through. I didn't even take a break. That I was fascinated with the creatures and with the mythology, and also how they handled Alexandra and her backstory. You know, maybe some people would want a longer, you know, it's only 6 episodes. Maybe somebody would want 10 or 12 to really start from the beginning to the end. But I thought the way they handled it, and particularly with much of the flashbacks in black and white, I thought was a really good choice also.
It really goes back to, and it explores the idea of how family is primary, very important, not to Filipinos, not just humans, but, you know, other than humans. And really, these are like tribes. The humans have the tribe, and they're all related to each other. And the Aswang have their tribe, and they're all related together. And then there's these creatures called the Tikbalang. You encountered them in, I think, the second episode. They're horse.
Yeah,
human, half horse. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they have their tribe. And when she meets the head of the Tikbalang, what's his name?
I can't think of it, but I know who you mean.
Yeah, yeah. The first thing foremost on the mind of the guy, the head Tikbalang, is his son, who's no good, spoiled brat, right? So it really comes down to family.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, there's the emissary to the underworld, and I mean, there's just so many wonderful gods and goddesses and creatures. I love the one that comes out of the cell phone. the god of fire.
Thelma. That's an old legend. It's a shortened version of the name Saint Elmo, Saint Elmo's Fire. So it's familiar to American and to Western, to sailors,
right.
Saint Elmo's Fire, right? And
we
also think it's a
movie.
Super, right?
Yeah, and I just said it's also a movie that many people would remember also.
Right. Demi Moore and Emilia Estevez?
Yeah, exactly. I think so.
Yeah. But, you know, if you're looking older, you know that St. Elmo's Fire is like a natural phenomenon, static electricity during a lightning storm, during a storm on board the ship. And, of course, the sailors who didn't know any better would think that it's some kind of spirit. And here it's literally a spirit that lives in a cell phone.
So do you have a favorite of the visualizations of the gods and monsters of the Philippines that are shown in this particular anime and Trezet?
Sure. The different creatures found in Trezet. Right now, my favorite for this first season is the Tiyanak, the changeling. And you can see its equivalent in Irish folklore, right? Russian.
There's a definite Russian, and we'll get into a little bit of that later. But which character are you talking about, the changeling?
The Tiyanak. He switches out with babies.
Oh, right. Okay, now I know which one you mean. Absolutely. Okay.
Right. Now that episode also, there's the mother is sort of parody recall. What's her name again?
You had it in your review, so let me get your review.
Nova
up.
Aurora. Now, Nova is like a parody name of Nora Honor, who's probably one of the Philippines' most famous actresses. It's not a vicious parody, I think. Totally different personality. This one is a self-centered, airhead, totally shallow actress, totally vain about her appearance. The real Nora Honor, I've met her once. I know her through her work, and I've heard stories about she's very shy. She's a very personal, you know, private person, incredibly talented, not very vain as far as I know. Like a dark skin, very typical Filipina type of beauty. And no, I don't find her shallow at all. But it's amusing to see how they kind of call back, she's famous, and then she has a baby, and, you know, it goes from there.
Right. I'll tell you the one I really like is the sewer rat guy.
Oh.
I love him.
Nunosa Punso. You
say that again?
Nunosa Punso. That's the Tagalog name. There are a lot of like ant mounds or just a mound of termite mounds, you know, in the Philippines. And it's a tradition. I've actually done this, or I've walked with someone who do this, where we'd encounter a little mound, a small mound of earth, and we'll say, tabi tabi po, you're asking permission to pass by from the creature that inhabits that mound. And if you don't do that, they'll curse you. They'll cover you full of warts or something like that, or what. This is a kind of update. He doesn't live in a mound. He controls those earth mounds. They become earth creatures, right? An earth elemental or whatever
right.
you call it. He lives in a manhole. That's an urban update. And he loves chalk nuts. Tresek keeps feeding him chalk nuts. And that's
right.
another music callback, because I grew up on those candy. I love eating them when I was a kid.
No, I mean, how much of your childhood and how much of the stories were you told when you were a kid and that you recognize in Treze? Because that was another thing I wanted to get into.
Yeah, practically all of them. The Tikbalang, the Tiana, the Aswang. And I've mentioned in my article, but usually your aunt or your mom, when they're putting you to sleep, yeah, you're being a naughty boy, they say, you watch out, because if you don't behave, that swan will get you. And they say, what kind of swan? And they start explaining, well, it's got the tube, and it'll go into your mother's uterus and start sucking you out. And they're like, you're well behaved after that. You stay up late at night.
Oh.
You're jumping at every sound and shadow that moves, because you're wondering if that's an aswang outside your window about to sneak its tongue in.
Yeah, you know, and that is a lot of what, you know, fairy tales and mythology are to do. There, it's a controlling sense of particularly for kids. You know, don't do this shit because this will happen, right? Go ahead, Noel. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, all the way back to the Grimm fairy tales. When you look at the Grimm fairy tales, anything from Red Riding Hood to who the heck was that? Red Riding Hood. And all those.
Any of those.
Yeah, the tales we know nowadays, they're kind of harmless. They're maybe a little scary. The original stories were horrific. They were terrifying. The funny thing, I used to read them to my kids when I was when they were really young, and they'd listen. They weren't scared. They were more like fascinated. Ooh, what the heck is that? You know,
yeah.
Chop off his toe, or they're gonna open him up and put stones inside, and that's amazing, you know. Children are bloodthirsty.
Yeah,
they love this stuff. They eat it up.
Well, I was the same way. I mean, it was basically my grandmother's. I come from a German and a Hungarian background. And I think there's a little Russian thrown in. But each of these areas have their own fairy tales. Okay.
Absolutely.
And I remember one that I grew up with that I fell in love with, which they actually did on Jim Henson's Storyteller. It's the Soldier in Death, which is about a soldier who gets a sack, that a magical sack that anything will get in, and he gets death in the sack because his daughter is dying. And it really ends up being like a Gilgamesh story, you know, the wandering soul who can't go to heaven or hell. My grandmother told me that story one night, and I was just fascinated. So I've read a lot. So I read a lot of these stories of different cultures. And that's the one thing I want to really impress on our listeners, you know, to give this a chance, because you're going to find a whole different perspective on folktales and mythology that you have not run into before. And I think that's really important.
Sure, sure. This is stuff I grew up with as a kid. The first episode is about a death of a woman on Baletta Drive. Baletta are
right.
Huge leafy trees common in the Philippines. And there's this one street in Manila lined with these trees. There's almost no sunlight because the trees overhead are so dense. And I grew up either riding a car down that street or driving down that street during the day and at late at night. So when I see the street and I'm watching and I hear about this white lady and I hear stories about the white lady, I pick her up, you drive her, and then when you let her off, she's gone and you find out she died years ago. You know, we've got similar kind of stories in other cultures, but that one hits home because, like, I grew up with those stories and I've been there. I know Baletta Drive. That's part of my childhood and my youth.
Yeah, and again, if you, I always say, if you see a film or something really, really has an emotional response when you're young, you know, that stays with you your whole life. That response, and you'll never forget it. So you're always gonna at least half believe in the white woman of Baletta Drive. Because you've been there,
sure.
You've heard those stories.
Yeah, you grew up with them, and you could swear you've seen her. Except
oh,
never did. The supernatural creatures have a point of staying away from me for some reason.
yeah, same here. Same here. But the show itself, I think, is well worth it. And I would recommend it to all our listeners. Do you have, you know, this is basically what we're going to cover today. Do you have any more thoughts on the show before we call it a night?
Oh, I don't know. Where do you want to start? There's the Aswang, the Tikbalang, the Tiana. There's some creatures we haven't seen, and I hope to see them if there's ever a second season. The Capre, he's a giant. He lives in a tree. He smokes a giant cigar. He smells of urine.
I would love to meet him. He should be here in New York. Anyway.
sounds like he's there, huh?
Yeah, exactly. The smell of urine.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And sometimes they fixate on young women. Maidens, basically, and I've met women, young women, who actually not have a relationship, but they've grown up knowing a capre who are watching over them, being jealous of them. If they go out on a date with a guy, the capre would cover them or the date with boils or. They talk to the capre over their shoulder and say, what do you think? Should I go out with this guy or not or whatever? It's a weird relationship. Some of them actually believe it's there, and some of them are just probably putting me on, you know.
Yeah.
It's weird. And there's the Manananggal. And that one, we've seen glimpses of him in some of the episodes, but we haven't really had an episode devoted to him. And the Manananggal is, I don't know if I've described him to you yet. Have I?
Okay. No, you have not.
Yeah. Usually a young girl, all the early descriptions, because I'm looking up these creatures, and some of them come from a book written by, I think, Dominican or Franciscan priest in the 1500s. So these are old mythologies. The Manananggal is a young girl. She, late night during the full moon, she'd rub an oil on her belly. She'd sprout a pair of giant bat wings, and she'd take to the air only her upper side. Her body would split, would tear in two where she had rubbed that ointment or oil, and she'd leave the lower half, her legs, on the ground, while the upper half, with the entrails hanging, would fly off somewhere. And that's basically a special form of a swang or a vampire. She'd, like I said, look for the tongue.
Mm-hmm. One other thing we haven't really touched is there's a character that we should mention who is human, who I really like, and that's Captain Guerrero, who is the captain that basically calls in Alexandra. And what do you think of him in his particular character?
He's interesting. Usually police captains in Philippine cinema are horrible people, corrupt, or they're usually the bosses behind the crime gangs that they're supposed to be fighting and all that sort of thing. He's supposed to be the good cop in a barrel of rotten apples. But he seems oddly convincing, a more complex character than these cliches usually are, the one good cop.
Right.
Because he was a good friend with the dad before. He knows Teresa. He looks on Alexandra Teresa as a sort of daughter, a daughter figure. And she looks at him as a sort of father figure. There's like a bond between them, like a fondness that I find intriguing. And he get the sense that he's done something wrong in the past. We never really get the full story, but there's like hints. He sounds like he's acting out of guilt. He's trying to do the right thing because he's done something wrong before. He's trying to make up for it. You know, so that's something that I'm hoping by flashback or something to learn more about his story. Maybe we won't, maybe we will. But that's one of the more intriguing characters in the series.
You know, and that's another thing to bring up, too, is that even though this is a anime and it deals specifically with folklore, there's still some political comment, particularly in the first episode where the mayor is the corrupt person. And of course, he, if you watch all six episodes, he comes back too. But you talk about corruption and that. What did you, you know, not that they did a lot with the political sense of you know, commenting, but what did you find as far as any political comment in Tese?
Well, I know that Bujetan, the actor, the mangaka, if you want, who wrote the series, explicitly they're not trying to be overtly political, but either by accident or by some kind of indirect design, some of the figures do have their equivalent in real life Philippine politics. That mayor is a callback to a certain mayor of a town that we shall not name who has since become president. Actually, there have been two mayors, ex-mayors, who have become president in the Philippines, and they're both pretty corrupt. And the conceit that they use supernatural forces to help back him up, relentless killers, bands of killers that go around randomly killing people, that has a real political resonance in the Philippines right now.
Right. And of course, with the particular first episode where he's setting fires to displaced people and then giving them to the Aswan. Not a good thing and not a good person, to say the least.
And different tribes, because a lot of the Philippine economy and a lot of Filipino power reside in these powerful families. And again, just for the sake of not starting any unnecessary fires. I won't name the families, but these families are powerful in Philippine society. And to either attach a sort of supernatural characteristic to them, one is maybe a family of tikbalang, of horse creatures, and they're all about transportation. Another is all about creatures of lightning, and they're involved in the Manila Power Company, so on and so forth. Or the Aswang are a different tribe and a different powerful family. So these are like, the Borgias, you know, the different powerful families
yeah.
with influence and corruption and complex relationships with living in uneasy truce with each other and a sort of uneasy treaty. And Alexander Tress is like a go-between between all of them. That's a fascinating thing. That's part of the ideas that I'm talking about that makes it fascinating despite the lousy animation or the less than great animation.
You know, there's one other pair of people we have not mentioned, and that is the two happy and sad compatriots of Alexandra, which you find out are part of her family, but adopted from the god of war. And those two characters I find very interesting as you go along, particularly in the later episodes, and it starts to realize who the big, big bad is. And I just gave it away, but that's okay. But they're fascinating too, those two characters.
The Kambal. Kambal is, what do you call this? It's a Tagalog Filipino for the twins, identical twins.
Right.
And as far as I'm concerned, the Kambal, that's my life. I am half of a pair of identical twins.
I didn't know
my
that.
Brothers, though, I don't know. I might have mentioned before. His name's Joel, Noel and Joel. And, the way they talk and the way they react to each other, that's pretty much like, yeah, that's me and my brother.
yeah. And then, of course, you have Bar, where you know, both humans and monsters can come and sit back and have a drink. And you have the bartender, Hank, who is also works with Alexandra. And again, I've always liked that idea of a bar where there are monsters and humans and they can like sit back and just take it easy. I like that a lot.
Yeah. I think that's a bit of a callback to remember in Buffy? Where they had this nightclub. No, not Buffy.
Right.
They had this nightclub, and it was brought by that demon with the green face. What's his name?
I can't remember, but yes, the demon with the green face. I know exactly who you mean.
Yeah, and there's like a truce between humans. I think it's a callback to that. I wish they were able to get more into that. Hopefully they can. Maybe they'll rebuild the bar. As far as I know, Hank's still alive, right?
Right, Hank is still alive.
Actually, alive. Hopefully, they'll rebuild that bar and we'll get more into it. That's a fascinating place. I'd love to see more of that. Like I said, this is more of a glimpse, more like a taste, right? A first installment or a deposit on what kind of world building this manga is able to offer us. And it's a fascinating world, a huge world. People have grown up on it and lived in it, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, and we should talk about the manga. I guess it's now available here in the U.S., but for the longest time it was just in the Philippines. And from what I understand, you know, there are like 15, 16 volumes now of stories. So they certainly have enough to keep going with the series. and hopefully the series is successful enough that we get more stories, because there's no question I want to see more of this universe. No doubt.
Sure. If anyone's disappointed, it's probably people who are familiar with the manga, and it's hard to be able to appreciate a story if you've already read the manga beforehand. Usually you're disappointed that it didn't come out the way I visualized it. I have not read the manga. I've read a few pages online, and I liked it. I liked the art. I liked the way Alexander Tressis conceived more chubby cheek, a little more sinister. Here she's more sympathetic, looking much prettier.
And let's not forget, she is a badass. She kicks monster butt like you wouldn't friggin' believe. Good God.
And the crazy thing is the fight sequences actually make sense the way they she'll make a move and that's smart. It's not like some stupid like Harry Potter climax where my magic light is stronger than your magic light or what magic light show. You know, my lightsaber stronger than your lightsaber. It's not like that. They actually outsmarts her enemy. And that's cool.
Oh, absolutely. Now, when I saw this extra program that they have on, which they call Treze After Dark, the two people that originated the manga, they made a definite switch at one point from a male protagonist to a female protagonist. And so in the manga, and of course here in the series, you have a female protagonist. How much does that change perception for you? Because for me, when I was growing up, I read all the private detective stuff. I know it was always male, but to see a female, particularly in what I presume is a very male-oriented, society in the Philippines. That must have, I think, made a couple of waves here or there. Would I be correct in saying that, Noel?
Kind of. Yes, there's a very male-oriented society in the Philippines. The Filipino machismo is something we've had to deal with, especially in the Filipino films. The cue they're coming off from is Buffy and the Vampire Slayer, strong female protagonists. I kind of went with the flow on that. I think it's more intriguing that way, that someone you'd like to ask out on a date with is perfectly capable of kicking your butt. You know what I mean? And, there's the sense that they're more vulnerable. Well, they look like they're more vulnerable. Actually, their looks can be very deceptive.
So exactly. You're underestimated, too.
Yeah. You're more worried for them that they'd get killed or something. Right.
Right. I grew up in the 70s. And the icon that I fell in love with was Pam Grier.
Oh,
okay, in Black Exploitation. And so the idea, and also even before that, Emma Peel and the Avengers. I've always had a thing for women that can kick my ass. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, sure. Emma, though, was part of a partnership with John Steed and all that. Yeah. The standalone female characters. Pam Grier was more of like that, like a standalone. She didn't need anyone, right?
No.
That's Cleopatra.
Except
Brown,
for Vic Diaz, but that's beside the point.
So Tressa, Alexander Tressa, she's part of that solid tradition. all the way to Buffy, to Miyazaki's anime heroines, the Studio Ghibli princess, you might say.
Right.
Yeah, they don't even need the love interest, not like those Disney princesses, right?
No, not at all.
No, they're far more intimidating. I mean, you remember Princess Mononoke? She blood out of her wolf mother, and then she just wipes her mouth, and like this blood smear in her mouth. I'm like, oh wow, hey, you don't know whether to be terrified or turned off.
Don't play around with her. Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. But again, I do recommend highly for our listeners to watch Treze. I think it's certainly a worthwhile effort. We talk a little bit about how the animation is perhaps lacking, but that to me is a very, very minor thing compared to the story and the characters, particularly the universe that you're thrown into, which is so unusual and so captivating that I think it just makes it more and more interesting to watch and to anticipate new stories and new seasons. So that's my take on Treze.
Mm-hmm. When you say, the animation may not be the best, I think like a challenge that actually think they're living up to. There have been anime series that where that's happened before. They start out at a big budget, then they run out of money towards the end. Neon Genesis Evangelion. Have you seen that series? Right?
Oh, absolutely.
Anime fantastic. Then in the last episode, they didn't have any money left. What did they do? They turned it into a psychodrama set in a high school gym. Do you remember that?
Yep.
Yeah. And it's all talk, and I found that fascinating. I'm like, okay, what do you do when you run out of money? You have them talk. So they talk about these crazy things, and, it's totally off the wall, and it's totally strange, and, like, I actually kind of love that, what you do when you don't have the money.
That's the beauty of low-budget filmmaking, whether it's live action or anime. You know, if you don't have the money, you find a way to make things work.
Yeah.
And that ability to do that and that makes it so much more interesting to me. And I do prefer low budget as a general rule.
Sure. So sometimes like the big bad, someone complains big bad does a 10-minute speech, so on and so forth. Yeah, I love that. Stop the action, have them make a big exposition, and go with the flow. We're going to learn some important things from that 10-minute exposition. And, it's a way of frustrating those ADHD, Pixar, Disney people who want a joke and an action sequence every 5 seconds.
Right.
You guys sit down and listen. And use your brain for once. You know what I mean?
And that's very true of the last episode of Treze. Because you get a lot of background and a lot of alternative things that you have to make a decision whether or not this character is telling the truth or not.
That's true. And you have to make a decision if you get the big revelation, what you're going to do with that revelation, right? So,
absolutely. And that's another thing I do want to bring up. And you brought it up very, very briefly. It's the sense of family. Because more and more as you go into the series, and particularly at the end, there's something that happened. It's about family. It's about the people around you that love you. And even though they may be gone, they're still there with you. And I believe that 100%.
What they say, blood is thicker than power, but there's something thicker than blood. I'm not going to say it. But in the beginning, Treze, Alexander Treze, starts the series without her mom and her dad. Still remembers them. She remembers them flash. She has a relationship with them. And that relationship, especially with the dad, changes through the course of the series. Fold under the pressure of what she learns or go with it and integrate it into herself and become stronger as a result. And that's why, you know, it may look like a power-up scene, but no, it makes sense in emotion, family dynamic sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we're getting here toward the end of the show. I just wanted to give you a chance to do a little self-promotion and talk about your writing and what you do and so on and so forth. So why don't you give us a little bit of information on that, Noel?
Sure. I write regularly for Business World. At least I come up with an article once a month. It's Filipino Daily. Comes out during weekdays. But I also reprint the articles, and I do my own articles in my blog, Critic After Dark at blogspot.com. That's my website. And, you know, I'll do articles on horror, on Filipino films, on anime, sometimes Disney hatchet job. that I try to keep up once a week. And like I said, I did one in Trece a few weeks ago. It's had its critics, and I try to reply to those critics best I can. I'm not saying you have to like the TV series, but I do say try give it a chance. It might sink with, it might hit with you, might land with you. I think it's unusual in many ways. And it's not the usual anime series, definitely. Not just the background, the mythology that it draws from, but the way where it goes and what it does with that mythology.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I do want to make a point of everything that I've read of Noel's on Critic After Dark. He's one of the best writers out there. And I would recommend everyone to check out his writing. And also, of course, your Facebook page, and that's Noel Vera, N-O-E-L-V-E-R-A. But, yeah, I think you're one of the best writers out there, and I really, really appreciate you coming onto the show and being one of our regular guests. I really appreciate it, Noel.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Okay, you're welcome. Now I'm just going to go very briefly into what we call housekeeping. So
sure.
On Friday tomorrow, Adam has a show on Catholic Ray Mission, and then on Saturday we're going to do a commentary watch of one of my co-host's favorite movies, and that's Stranger Than Fiction with Will Ferrell and Dustin Hoffman. And Emma Thompson. Then, of course, this weekend is July 4th, and we're going to do two commentary watches. One is on Sunday, and I always watch two movies during July 4th. One is 1776. That is not the movie we're going to be watching on Sunday. Pardon me. Sinuses, I love summer. But we're going to be doing a commentary watch on a film that's written by Larry Cohen and directed by William Lustig. And it's a very satirical horror comedy, which stars Isaac Hayes. And that would be Uncle Sam. And we're going to do that on Sunday. And then on Tuesday, I was going through the idea of doing a show on films about Independence Day, but I've decided to do something a little different. And we're going to do, and I don't know if you know about this, Noel, but we're going to do a commentary watch on a film called Last flag flying. Now, have you heard about that film, Noel? Do you know anything about it?
What's it about?
Okay, so let me give you the setup. There's a film in 1973 that was written by Daryl Ponickson called The Last Detail. Are you familiar with that film?
Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson, Randy Quaid, Otis Young. The motherfucking Shore Patrol, that one. Okay?
Yeah.
Last Flag Flying is a direct sequel. Now, it was done by Amazon, so they couldn't use the names. But it's written by the same person who wrote Last Detail. And it is from the novel that is a direct sequel. And so you take those three characters 25 years later. And the one that was put into jail has gotten out. And his son was deployed to Afghanistan and killed in Afghanistan. And he seeks out both Petoskey and Otis Young to accompany him to Arlington to pick up the body. And it is much like in terms of The Last Detail. There are comic moments. There are a lot of different things that happen, but ultimately it definitely tugs at the heartstrings. And it stars Steve Carell, Lawrence Fishburne, and Bryan Cranston. So you're talking about, you know, major acting and script in that, and it's really well done. And it's directed by Richard Linklater.
Oh yeah, so, I know him.
Yeah, it's directed by Linklater. So that's what we're going to do on Tuesday. We're going to do a commentary watch on that particular film, because that's a film that I ran across. I didn't even realize that it had been made. And then I ran across it and just like, oh, it's a great film. So we're going to do that on Tuesday. So join us for that. Again, Joel, I just want to say thank you so much for being on. Again, if you ever have anything you want to talk about, all you have to do is let me know and you're scheduled. Not a problem, sir.
Sure. I owe you Richard Rush one of these days.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think we're going to have to back down on that simply because Gary it's just not going to work with Gary right now.
Yeah.
So we'll come up with something else. You know, so unfortunately, that was one that we had to cancel and sort of went into the trash bin, unfortunately.
Sure.
But again, as I said, we'll certainly see you again on the podcast here soon, I'm sure. And again, for everyone that's listening, I want to say thank you very much for listening. Again, thank you, Noel. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to call it a night. All right.
All right.
Okay, everybody's good night, everyone, and thank you very, very much for being here. Good night.